breaking myself. I need to expose this crooked doctor's wealth. Insurance every time, surely the next paid millions.
All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Justice Team podcast. Today's panel is a unique one, and we're going to cover a topic called civil rights, which not a lot of people know what it is.
A lot of people are scared to practice it.
I borderline don't know what to do here because I've never done it. I'm afraid to do it. But what I must say, our panel today is the best dressed panel I've ever seen. I don't know if that's custom in your field of practice.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we have the Simon brothers here, minus Brad, Brandon, who's terrible, our youngest. So you get the
twins. He doesn't even know which one I am.
Y'all look alike.
What could I say? I think my mom and dad were brother and sister, baby. I don't know.
We were close to West Virginia. That's
close enough. So we have first seated furthest away from us, Mr. Stephen King. And Stephen, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you.
Do something you're not used to, which is talk about yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, tell me about it. Stephen King, I'm a civil rights lawyer. I originally started doing criminal defense as a public defender. So I did that, had a lot of fun in the courtroom. Yet I wanted my office to be the courtroom. And so I did that for about 4 or 5 years. It was great. Then I went out in private practice, started doing civil rights, kind of fit, dealing with cops, police abuse, police corruption. It just felt like a right fit. Finally, I'm over at Carpenter, Zuckerman, and Rowley, where we do personal injury as well as civil rights. And so now I'm just a civil justice lawyer.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, man. And just battling it out in the courtroom. So that's what I do. That's what I like to do.
And you have another platform called Courtroom Etiquette. Could you tell our listeners about that, how they can find you?
Oh, yeah. Courtroom Etiquette is just www.courtroometiquette.com. We cover kind of like what lawyers do in and out in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. So everything from fashion to what their hobbies are. We have a lot of lawyers that, have their own sushi restaurant, or maybe they enjoy biking, or they have a guitar collection, or whatever it is. We try to show the humanity, basically what lawyers do at home, what's
Speaking
their passion.
About what lawyers do at home, Murat, what do you got for us to drink today?
Well, I thought I would treat everyone to a nice, healthy cocktail today. So we are enjoying the Morning Mule, which is basically the Moscow Mule with orange juice in it. So I'm guessing someone woke up one day and thought to themselves, I really want to have a Moscow Mule right now. And they knew they were going to be judged. So they thought, you know what? If I put a little splash of OJ in it, it becomes totally acceptable.
Great choice.
Yeah. Yep. So today we're joining the Morning Mule.
You've made a long way since the beer mosas in your college days, Murat. So congrats.
Yes, we've come a long way from the bamosa.
Bamosa. We also have Miss Asia. I want to thank you for coming on. And Asia, you have we're bitter rivalries because you're from Baltimore. So you're from Maryland. So
No. Born and raised in Los Angeles. Oh,
Amanda Maryland. Took,
I just needed a break after I graduated UCLA, so I went across the country to Maryland. Great experience.
I think it's
love the East
pronounced
Coast.
Merlin.
Not if you're from Al Lotte. But I'm a diehard Ravens fan. I think we're gonna do well this year. So
far so good.
Yeah.
But I think the only things I know of that are good that came out of Baltimore is The Wire and Cal Ripken. Is that true?
No.
Soft shell crabs are good.
Yeah, you got to show some love for the crabs.
The crabs are amazing, to be quite honest. I don't like soft shell, but no.
Those weren't the same crabs you got in college, right?
No, these were...
Totally we went to college in D.C. D.C., we went to college.
Yeah, I'm talking about the waterfront seafood restaurants.
Yeah. Well, Asia, thank you for coming on today.
Problem.
Because you have a pretty lengthy history with civil rights starting back to your law school days. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in this direction?
I was kind of in the middle. I didn't see too many things that I was personally offended by, but definitely coming on board on the plaintiff side with respect to civil rights is where I feel like I should be. And I think I bring a different perspective because I have been on the defense side. And so I have both of those sides to kind of help me be a better lawyer for Mr. Douglas.
And where do you work now, Asia?
I work for the best lawyer in all of the country, Carl Douglas and Douglas Hicks Law.
That's a good segue to talk about yourself over there.
Well, Asia, you did some work with ESPN. You did a few work with some of the famous athletes that I saw as well.
Not specifically ESPN, but I have represented Keyshawn Johnson, who's an ESPN radio show talk host right now, and Keisha Cole, Vince Staples, Freddie Gibbs right now.
Nice.
So, yeah.
And another man known to be on ESPN 30 for 30s, and a man that needs, like, not a lot of introduction, but maybe you need your ego strike a little bit there and there. But Mr. Carl Douglas, who's one of the most famous trial lawyers of any generation, and, you know, going back to his early days and trying some tough cases for consumers, for people, police brutality, touching cases we would never touch with some of the worst warts we've ever heard of ever. And I've been honored enough to be on a couple of trial panels with Mr. Douglas, and his advice is just phenomenal. One of the best orators I've ever seen.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
So I want to introduce you. Give us a little more flavor about who you are, bro. Let's hear it.
I'm from Los Angeles as well. I, like Stephen, began on the criminal side. Mm. We find that many...
You were a criminal?
Well, that too. that too. But I started my professional career as a federal public defender in Los Angeles, trying federal cases. Working there for 5 years, I then began working for Johnny Cochran, and I was there as his manager for 12 years before opening my own office 22 years ago.
Wow.
Being from Los Angeles, there's a unique relationship that all of us here are aware of concerning the relationship between the African-American community here and the police. And it is in that environment that I was raised. Johnny Cochran, one of the heroes for all of us since the 70s, and it has always been a part of my life to represent those that have been mistreated because of the misconduct of law enforcement officers. It's a tremendously gratifying way to practice law. I do that, but I also handle serious injury cases along with Asia and the other lawyers at Douglas X Law in Ladera Heights. And we're doing employment cases as well, trying to give the voice to the voiceless.
And how have you experienced the change in the landscape of the relationship between the police and the community since you started your practice until today?
Brad, there has been a tremendous difference in many ways, but at the same time, the more that things change, my friend, the more they say the same.
Wow.
I wish the LAPD would put me out of business. I wish I would not have to represent mothers and fathers of young men and women who have been mistreated by sheriff deputies. We represent people from across the country and in states from Maine to Mississippi, and I wish it was less of a problem than it is. I will say, though, that things are improving in large part because of technology. Rodney King, I think, started it all, but police misconduct left from the shadows into the bright lights because everyone now has a camera on their hip. And all of America has been able to see things and stories that we who practice here, I've been in the trenches for 40 years, have heard for years, and it's now coming to light. But regrettably, the more things change, there still is a problem. There still is much work to be done.
Well, and I'll pivot and I'll ask this side of the room, Asia and Steve, have you seen a difference in when you're talking to juries and you're talking about these issues? Are they more educated and knowledgeable about this? I mean, how are you able to elicit these things from the juries you've seen when you're doing these types of cases?
Well, I've been doing it for 13 years, but really, I feel like my real career started when I became a lawyer for Mr. Douglas. Jurors are more knowledgeable. I think one of the most important questions that we ask jurors in voir dire is, where do you get your news from? Mm. And that tells us a lot about the person, and we really use that to kind of hone in on what type of person we're dealing with and try to, you know, what we're there to is trying to figure out what they feel about our particular case, our particular client, the particular facts of our case. And so, yes and no, they are more knowledgeable, but there's still a lot of implicit bias out there and feelings that don't necessarily come out that we have to deal with ultimately. Yeah,
so how do you sort that out? You're sitting there picking a jury. No one's going to raise their hand and say, yep, I'm a racist. I mean, right?
Yep. I hate all black people right here.
Yeah, I mean, nobody says that. Nobody does these things. Well, maybe sometimes.
Right.
But how do you flush that out with, you know, without being overtly asking those questions? Because it's hard.
It is particularly hard. I have been called the jury whisperer right now because I think my background, I'm a sociology major. I have always liked to study behavior and how people think and act. And so I think I have a good innate intuition about reading people. And so I look at the clothing that they're wearing. I look at books that they're reading. I look at how they respond to answers. I look at how they look at me, how they look at our clients, how they look at the district attorney, how they speak, where they came from, their upbringing. Depending on how much time we get, the more time, the more able we're able to flesh out. Some judges don't give us a lot of time, so we just kind of, you know, roll with whatever we have.
Wow. How about for you, Steve?
You know, I think jurors are a lot more aware these days because of what's on the news and what they see. Police abuse, police corruption. But there's still a certain degree of skepticism. Mm. You know, you have a client at the end of the day who's sitting there who may have been on drugs at the time of the incident, may have a criminal record, may have tattoos. And so that skepticism that they may have concerning really, did the cop really do something wrong, or did this guy really have a knife, or was he about to kill someone? And if we don't have officers like that interceding, what if that guy ends up at my door and it's too late? So it's never going to go away. And the concern usually resides in how I feel about representing someone who I truly believe needs justice. And so a lot of times I may share a bias that I have. I may share something about the awesome responsibility I have representing this person, or maybe when I first met them, the concerns that I had, like, well, what if this guy really is dangerous? Or what if, how would I react if I saw this person walking down the street? So when I start my cases, I generally share a bias. I say, you know, folks, we all have biases and prejudices, or we wouldn't be human. You know, for example, me, I may say that I don't take divorce cases because when I was young, my family, my mom and dad, got a divorce. Or just something that I really feel in that moment as to why I'm not completely clean either, and it's okay. And I kind of raise my hand, and I try to sort of have a dialogue. And one thing I've been trying to do at the end of the day is now sort of instill in the jurors, like, even if we cover it up now, because we need this brutal honesty, right? We need to kind of build a tribe and find justice the best that we can as a community, representatives for the community.
Who was your inspiration to get into to do the line of work that you're in?
I have to say Carl Douglas. Wow. You know, no, really. Wow. You know, Johnny was still around, and I had met Johnny's and his mom and his dad, and we went to the office. But my interactions with Carl, you know, as a young lawyer, said it all. He was federal public defender. And, you know, on the federal side, I mean, you got to keep everything tight and to the punch. And so the manner by which everything that Carl said and did and how he carried himself, it was just the epitome of lawyerism. You know,
that,
and I always wanted
word?
To be like
Can we get
a lawyerism.
You know, one thing that Steve says that's real important, whether you're practicing civil rights law or any kind of law, it is trying to develop that connection with the jury. And in civil rights cases in particular, we have clients that have what I call warts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Often they don't have a job at the time. They were often under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Many times they were doing something wrong that brought the police to their orbit at that moment in time.
You listened to this, Marat? You got all this information?
But you as the lawyer, and it's a Jerry Spence technique, I know, if you show them something about yourself, some weakness of yourself, basically, if I show you mine, you'll show me yours. And I've had cases in civil rights cases where I would disclose in voir dire the concerns I had because I didn't really like the decedent, perhaps, because of the things that I heard.
So
you're
talking about your own client.
My own client.
Yeah.
I was afraid because if I don't like him, you may not like him either, even though what happened to him was wrong. And sharing that vulnerability in myself will hopefully allow the jurors to open up as well.
Well, so when you have a client like that, I mean, you're picking the jury, you're talking about this. How do you get the jury to want to compensate that person that even you may not like?
It is a struggle because I would say, Bob, other than doctors, there is more general credibility given to law enforcement officers. They're the last line of protection between me and anarchy in many ways. And that makes it particularly difficult because no one comes into the courtroom with that same shield of invincibility as the law enforcement officer. Most of my clients look like me. They are black or brown. They are impoverished. They are someone that you probably would look away from or cross the street if you're walking that part, the same part of town as they. So there's a tremendous challenge that you have to overcome. Aside from a lawyer or two, none of us handle too many of these cases because it's difficult to support a personal injury practice on police cases. They don't settle very easily or often. I can count, I dare say, on one hand, the number of times that an officer has told me, Mr. Douglas, you know, I probably did use a little more force than was reasonable. Or, Mr. Look, you know, that other co-defendant, yes, probably did hit him more than he should have hit him at that moment.
And to the law enforcement, do they hide these documents and statements from you? I mean, do they just give you all these good things or what?
They just lie.
Wait, you know that because you're on the other side.
It's always been a challenge, and it will always be a challenge because they have this shield of invincibility and a reluctance to concede their own humanity. We all make mistakes.
And do you think it's worse, like, in Los Angeles, the LAPD, than other areas? I mean, generally, do you think it's an epidemic here, or is it nationwide? For any of our panelists, I mean, just what are your general thoughts?
I think you'd be able to speak more about that, but I was just going to interject very briefly that we, Carl and I also, and I'm sure Steve, black lives are just not valued as much as other lives, black and brown lives. So that's another struggle, getting a jury to award us a certain amount of money for a black life, because they just don't value our lives like they do others.
And how? But so then, how do you get the jurors to do that? And I represent a lot of people that are the similar backgrounds for injury cases, and many of the times, you know, I almost dare the jury and just say, you know, we're here because they don't think you're going to do it. They think that they see this person here and they say, well, that's not a lawyer, it's not a doctor, it's not my dentist. You know what? I'm not going to give them full justice, full compensation, right? They don't think you're going to do it, but I do. You know, we spent 2 weeks talking to you, picking this jury. We know we got fair people that are going to do the right thing for a person across the board. But I mean, the situation you're describing, when you're doing civil rights, it's just not an injured person who may be completely innocent by somebody else's negligence. They may have committed some crime.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Sure.
So, I mean, when you're talking about compensation, I mean, how do you deal with that issue? Because for me, that's very hard as a human to, like, conceptualize helping someone give money if I know they're not the best seed in the world. You know what I'm saying? Like, if they're not perfect.
It speaks to the challenge that we as civil rights lawyers face trying to identify that common bond that connects all of us, a father, a husband, a brother, a wife, those kinds of common bonds that you can hopefully draw on so that you can better humanize the individual, because often they do have significant warts that you have to deal with.
And we talk about civil rights a lot. We have listeners that don't have any legal background. What is civil rights, and what types of cases does that encompass? And we'll start with Mr. King over here.
You know, civil rights essentially is anytime you're suing a governmental agency. You know, not only police abuse cases, but I've also sued like Children Protective Services, DCFS. Mm-hmm. And really the analogy is the same, whether it's Fourth Amendment, unlawful seizure, or maybe even 14th Amendment, where you're interfering with a parental relationship. I had a case where a child was taken away from the parent without a warrant. And so the first issue was there exigency? Was there exigent circumstances such that you didn't have time to go get a warrant? So wherever we have Fourth Amendment, 14th Amendment, public governmental entities, in my view, and we're dealing with constitutional issues, that's civil rights, that's civil justice.
And in California, we have a state civil rights statute that allows practitioners to broaden the expansion. I have a case, for example, against the largest pharmaceutical retailer in the world, and they had a discriminatory deployment of security guards. Guards in the black community were armed. Guards in the white community were unarmed. And my client was a 20-year-old black male who walked into a store, was harassed by a guard. He complained about his mistreatment, that he's being profiled because of his race, because he was clearly gay, because he was clearly homeless. And following a brief scuffle, there was a dispute. And as he was trying to leave the store, the guard shot and killed him, firing a bullet in his back. The guard has criminal problems in itself, but we are suing that retailer because we allege there was a civil rights violation by the nature of how they make a deployment.
That's a private entity, though.
Correct.
How do you apply like the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, to a private entity?
You can apply the Unruh Act, which is a California civil rights statute that says even businesses are not allowed to discriminate because of one's race. You can't put armed guards in a store because there are black patrons, simply because they are black patrons. You can't prevent someone from shopping or charge another fee or have a different standard for admissions because of their race, their religion, their sex, their sexual orientation. So that is how the civil rights statute on the state side can be broadened for all kinds of good.
So these protected classes are more protected in California. Are there other states where it's similar protection, or is California kind of the leading state in that broadening the protection?
New York has anti-discrimination laws. Many, many forward and fair-minded states do, but few come to the level of the Unruh Act and the Bain Act in California, as it protects against all kinds of mistreatment based on protected classes.
So do you think that your advocacy and your practice has helped shape California to be a better state in general?
Brad.
Short answer, yes.
We would like to think so.
Absolutely.
I wake up, and if someone's life is better because I walked on this earth, that's a feeling of satisfaction that no amount of money can duplicate.
Wow. So the hypothetical you just talked about, the case against the pharmaceutical company, why not? What is the advantage you have of bringing the civil rights aspect to it rather than just a straight negligence case? Just for a listener, like, why strategically would you do something like that?
It's a case against Walgreens. Mm-hmm. Walgreens is the largest pharmaceutical retailer. Walgreens made $1.38 billion in 2018. They made $1.17 billion in 2017. Clearly, if you have armed guards at a pharmacy, there is the foreseeable expectation that the guard is going to use his gun. Mm-hmm. Clearly, if you have a guard using his gun at a pharmacy, there's a foreseeable expectation that someone will be injured unintentionally. So corporate executives at Walgreens made a corporate decision to place profits over their property, over the safety of their customer base. Because nothing at Walgreens is valued at more than $60.
Exactly.
They don't sell electronics. They don't sell jewelry. This is my opening statement.
Right. I like this. See?
So in order to get the attention of the executives at Walgreens, we have asked for $500 million, which would only be less than 1% of Walgreens' profit, but it gets the attention of Walgreens.
But this is, we would take that case and look at it, okay, this is a negligence case.
Mm-hmm. No.
You're going to look at it from a civil rights aspect, which I would never even think about doing. So, Asia, why would that be important? What benefits would you have by putting in a civil rights violation?
Because it really wasn't just negligence. And there's a video. So when that video is shown, this young man who did nothing wrong to anyone simply came into Walgreens to purchase an item that was less than $5. He was profiled because he was black. He was profiled because he was homeless. He was profiled because he was gay. He was shot in the back of the neck while trying to get away from this officer. That's not negligence. That's an intentional tort. And it was done because he was black. And that's our position, and that's why we've alleged civil rights violations as opposed to just negligence.
And Walgreens doesn't have armed guards at its store in the Valley.
Exactly.
It doesn't have armed guards at its store at Pico and Fairfax. It doesn't have armed guards at its store at Marina Del Rey. Florence and La Brea, 6th and Vermont, Sunset and Vine, which is the flagship store, which is 24 hours and caters to young, homeless people in the gay communities. So by getting the attention and by saying $525 million is what our prayer is, $25 million for the deaf, $500 million for the civil rights violation, because wow. But for the grace of God, any of us could have our kids going into Walgreens and be subjected to this because of choices that the executives in Deerfield, Illinois made.
And let me ask another question, because a lot of our listeners either want to do civil rights or don't do it. Whenever you're suing, for instance, police brutality, mm-hmm. who are the defendants that you're actually naming, and what are the potential recoveries you could have against them?
So we name individual defendants, individual officers, the shooters, generally the officers who were there participating in whatever the incident was, as well as the agency. The officers usually don't have much money, so they're named for the purpose of they were the actual culprits of the act. But we get most of our money from the agencies, whatever the police departments are, the sheriff departments, and those.
So is it like a negligence case where they're like vicariously liable because
correct.
They're in the,
okay. Yes. Sometimes you can sue the chief of police if there's a policy, a practice, or a custom of mm-hmm. that department that is discriminatory. And in that way, you can bring in the entire department and you can bring in the leadership of the department as continuing a policy that is contrary to the public good or illegal.
So in that case, you mentioned you were going to ask $25 million for the death and $500 million for the civil rights violation. What additional damages are you getting just because it's a civil rights case? Is there
attorney fees. That's the hook in the case. That's the attraction of the case.
Okay.
And clearly.
Right.
And you're doing
punitive,
social good. You
punitive
know?
Damages as well.
But you're doing social good because I'm from Los Angeles, from the city. This is my community. Mm-hmm. And if anyone listening can use your talents to do well and to do good, that's the best of all worlds, man. Yep. I got a big old car in the parking lot here. I got a big house in Ladera Heights. I got an ex-wife with very fine taste that expects to have her check on time every month. I have no problem making money. But when you can do well and do good with this fortunate thing that we call a law degree, that's the best of both worlds.
I mean, I want to thank you guys for coming down behind the orange curtain, too. I
think. We don't come out here too often.
Make sure I'm back before the sun sets.
So, Stephen, I'm going to ask you, why don't you comment on our style here with your courtroom etiquette? Like, what do we got going on? Well, some people are listening on iTunes or Spotify. Some people are watching on YouTube and will get to see. So tell us, what are we seeing here?
Well, you know, I think everybody's doing a good job, especially Mr. Douglas, of course, right? It's just all about coordinating. You know, I like your blazer there. You got the jeans, the boots. You know, everybody's kind of showing off their socks a little bit, a little socks etiquette here. Mm. See Mr. Douglas.
Got Where'd you color. Get those socks, Mr. Yeah. Douglas? Those are nice.
Asia Man get me these
what?
Socks. Asia Man gives the best gifts. I have my own bobblehead doll from Asia Man, which is fabulous.
What are you wearing in your bobblehead doll? Like, what is it?
I'm wearing a shirt and a jacket, and it looks like me. That's the best thing about it all. She gives the best gifts of anyone around.
With all the bling. Let's not forget Miss Man's. Tennis shoes
yeah,
there.
Please.
I thought
Those
I was wearing good. Nice custom shoes, but I think she got me beat. You know, I actually got my initials in my shoes,
of
by the way.
Of course you do.
There
what?
You go. There you go.
There's an S right there and a K.
And sure enough, the K. Sure
Interesting
enough.
Thing about style. Carl Douglas has commented on my style in trial numerous times. Sometimes he thinks it's a bit much, but that's kind of just me. I have to bring mm-hmm. a little style to everything that I do. Once I wore some shoes that were glittery, and he said, Asia Man, in the 40 years that I've been doing this, I have never seen an attorney wear glitter shoes in trial.
Well, just okay. Me. I got to ask this question to Carl Douglas. I heard this story when he had this verdict with a B at the mm-hmm. some billion-dollar verdict, that this man wore a purple suit one of the days.
Oh, and
Is
he
this
still
true?
Wears it.
I heard about this.
Yes, it is true. It's plum.
It came from OJ.
It's plum.
And he wore it in the OJ trial as well, didn't you, Carl Douglas?
I wore that suit when I was one of Mr. Cochran's lawyers representing OJ Simpson. And there was an article written by a former columnist there named Sandy Banks. And Ms. Banks noted how great the sartorial splendor was of the defense team. And there was one lawyer there with a suit the color of plum. I dare say, Mr. Simon, I still have the jacket. I don't wear the pants anymore with them. I wouldn't dare. But the jacket still fits. Most of you from 23 years would only have socks that would still fit. I think my jacket still fits.
Smithsonian. I think the Smithsonian is listening. We have the jacket.
If the jacket fits, you must acquit.
Absolutely right. Please do. I'm so proud the jacket still fits. I can't close it, but the jacket fits.
So civil rights is a very difficult area of law to get into. And we may have some young legal listeners out there that want to start doing civil rights law. Besides the advice of don't do it, how would you guide someone into that area of practice?
It's got to be expensive, I would imagine, these cases.
Not necessarily. Most plaintiff lawyers are former criminal defense lawyers because you are basically prosecuting a criminal case. Mm-hmm. I am a better civil rights lawyer because I spent years cross-examining police officers who are the best, most professional, most practiced witnesses that they are. Being a criminal lawyer gives you a distinct advantage, I say, not only because you understand criminal procedure, which is important, but you learn to cross-examine on your feet. Hmm. Criminal lawyers aren't always given the advantage of depositions before they have to ask questions. And the ability to adjust and to ask questions on your feet, Steve will tell you, is a skill that most plaintiff lawyers lack, and it is a distinct advantage that a criminal lawyer has being a plaintiff. Steve, talk about that.
Absolutely. You know, you got to be a prosecutor, essentially, if you're doing civil rights, because you have the best of the best up there on the stand. Those guys are all professional witnesses. And, you know, even when you file these lawsuits, if you name four defendants, four different cops, when you're taking a deposition of cop A, cop B, C, D, and E are sitting right there.
Really?
They're right there. You know, during the breaks, they're talking, they're coming in, and they're just rotating seats.
And how many times do you see the exact same players?
Well,
how many times you guys depose, like, the chief of LAPD, blah, blah?
All the time. Right, Carl?
I've had the same officer involved in two shootings 6 weeks apart.
What?
And still out on the street after been A.
6 weeks apart. Same cop.
So you definitely have to be able to think on your feet. You know, because it can't, you know, when I'm asking questions, it's either the tail wagging a dog or the dog wagging the tail. You know, if you have loose, floppy questions, that officer has you where he wants you, and it's going to be embarrassing. You know, so you really have to have control of your examination. You have to ask questions in a way, even cadence, even mannerism. Even you don't sit down at a seat and question an officer, right? It's all about command. It's all about them respecting you. It's all about taking away that power they think they have. So you have to let them know right up front. You tell the jury that these are professional witnesses.
And Asia, this might be tougher for you than anybody in this room to be asking questions in trials because you're African-American and you're a woman. And you're going against power figures that probably look down on you. And how have you dealt with that in your career, and how have you adjusted?
You're absolutely correct. I still get stopped sometimes from coming in the well, asking me, am I actually an attorney? So I have experienced that quite a bit. I actually had a trial with Mr. Douglas's partner, Jamon Hicks, where after we whooped their tails, the defense counsel refused to shake my hand.
What?
So it is still there. I think one of the reasons Carl Douglas keeps me around is because I am not your normal
Jerry Whisperer.
I'm not your normal young lady. I can be aggressive. I try to mimic Mr. Douglas's style as much as I can.
Nobody can.
I try
Carl
to command.
Douglas,
you know, the room. I'm being taught that daily on how to take control, be a voice. I speak my mind. I curse a little. So
love it.
This
has been a clean show, by the way, which is very troubling.
We need another round.
Right.
I've been on a few panels, and I have an over-under for Mr. Douglas's F-bombs.
But I am always I'm here for every challenge. So
Well, let me ask you, because you've been on the other side of things, how are these officers being prepared for these testimony that you guys have all talked about? I mean, do they have like their focus groups? Do they have people training them how to answer questions? How's that go down?
Before they even get to us, they are trained on how to answer questions. Wow. So by the time they're in our office, they've already been taught on what to say, how to say it.
This is the party line. Party line.
You know, thankfully was not in the office that I saw too many unethical things being done. I think that would have made me leave that space quicker than I did. But again, they come to us already fully prepared on what to say.
And Bob, the code of silence is alive and well.
Absolutely.
Because police work is dangerous.
Absolutely.
And I, as a cop, have to know that you're going to be there and you have my back when my life might be on the line. So that creates a certain bond. They say, you're not white, you're not black, you're blue. Wow. And that bond is in place, which makes it so difficult. So they are already in sync with their versions of what happened. They're already in sync with what the plaintiff or the defendant did wrong. They're in lockstep with each other. It is a culture, and it's something that has to change for there ever to be real justice.
And I got to ask you, I mean, you're going up against very powerful people that have a lot of resources and a lot of people that want to see you fail. Do you ever think your life is in danger?
That's funny. My mother has had a fear of my being mistreated for the 36 years that I've been suing police. And knock on wood, I've never had a negative encounter with the police in my entire life. But I've had enough stories of those that have to understand and to respect the awesomeness of their job, the importance of what they do. Whenever someone breaks into my house, I'll call the police. I'm a police supporter. Give me more cops. I get all of that. But with that awesome power comes responsibility.
Thank you, Stanley.
That being said, to your listeners, there's no more interesting, fun way to make a living as a lawyer than as a police lawyer. These cases are fun. There are more cops and robbers shows on the network than any other genre.
I watch one every night. Find a new one every night.
They are fascinating. Every one of our cases, while difficult, are interesting.
Absolutely.
So how many of these cases can you justify taking? Because you mentioned you can't support a practice on it. What percentage of your portfolio of cases would you say is specifically civil rights?
Our office is probably less than 20%. I know lawyers who have 100% practice. Dale Gallipo makes his living doing nothing but civil rights cases, God bless them. Most firms cannot support that. I, like members of your firm, am a master of many trades. Jack of all trades, master of none. I do employment cases. I do PI injury cases.
So employment law, it seems like there's going to be a lot of crossover between an employment case and a discrimination case.
Absolutely.
So, Asia, have you ever encountered where, hey, you're looking at this employment case and wait a minute, there's a civil rights aspect to it?
Well, generally speaking, most of the employment cases that we have taken do have the aspect it was a wrongful termination based on some protected class, based on the fact that the person was older, that they were black or brown, that they were sexual orientation. So generally speaking, when there is a wrongful termination or failure to accommodate or something, it is based on some civil right aspect.
So do you, for our listeners, because a lot of people take that employment case and they don't file the civil rights aspect to it. I mean, I think it's a lot of mistake that our listeners that they do. I mean, so you have the advantage of, so do you get amplified attorney's fees? Because with employment cases, there's the attorney fee statute.
Right.
So how does that work if you're also alleging the civil rights aspect?
You're able to petition for a multiplier, which is an enhanced multiplication table, 2% or one point something, that basically rewards the practitioner for the challenge of taking on these cases. They aren't quick money.
Right.
Employment cases are always MSJ and then settle. So they're always a challenge for the practitioner. but they're fun and they are worth the effort.
I would imagine that in practice of civil rights and employment, there's a lot of paper that goes on too. So, I mean, is that something that y'all here have mastered? Do you have people in your office that's all that they do? I'm just trying to figure out for our listeners, if you want to go into this space, what do you got to be ready for?
Civil rights cases, you got to be ready to try the case.
Right.
They are not afraid of going to trial. Police officers, I'm sure Steve can confirm, win a higher percentage of cases than probably all categories other than doctors and malpractice cases. So they're very tough to win. To be a good lawyer, you can't be afraid to lose. And that's one advantage that we, coming from the criminal arena, take with us. In civil, there's so many consequences of losing financially that many civil lawyers are really afraid, unless it's a slam dunk. As a civil rights lawyer, you can't be afraid to lose because the cops are fearless. Their lawyers are fearless. And as I say, they never acknowledge responsibility for using unreasonable force or for discriminating. Steve can speak to that as well.
Oh, absolutely. And the benefit of doing these cases, because you make changes, you change policies. And the only way you could do that is by taking them all the way to the mat, because they're never going to admit it. They're never going to make a change.
The LAPD used to have a practice of choking men by a chokehold. When I was a lawyer in Johnny Cochran's office, we sued them so many times for chokeholds that it became financially inadvisable and the policy changed.
Wow.
Daryl Gates used to say that African-American men had a different construction in their neck.
What?
Making them susceptible to dying from chokeholds.
Get out of here.
But because we sued for chokehold cases and won, and it became financially bad for the city, the police department changed their policy, and no longer are there chokeholds that are applied during arrests. So that's how there can be real change through civil rights legislation.
And that's what I want to ask, because we also like to inspire a lot of our viewers, and they probably have had a lot of that already today. So I want to know, we heard one from Carl. I'm going to ask each one of you this question. What are some things where a case or a movement or a series of cases you've had that have actually changed procedure, not just that individual case, but categorically? If you can think of another example. Steve?
Well, the case I talked about earlier, the case against DCFS, where they were taking children away from their parents without warrants. And essentially, that was a warrantless seizure. During that case, it lasted about 7 weeks in trial. I did it with an attorney named Sean McMillan, and sort of his specialty in this particular area. They had never, ever, ever requested a warrant from a judge for a seizure. In fact, the presiding judge in the dependency court saw what was going on and actually wrote a memo to the entire department of Child Protective Services saying, what you guys are doing is wrong. You need to come in and request warrants. You can get night warrants. You can call in warrants, et cetera, et cetera. There were 13 memos that the presiding judge wrote to the Department of Children and Family Services. Still, not one time did they request a warrant until that trial, which lasted 7 weeks, and we exposed the fact that they were taking children without exigent circumstances, without a warrant, and they knew it. And there were maybe about 600 times that they did that, and it was wrong, and they did it anyways. Wow. Following that trial, now you have to get a warrant.
So what are the damages like in that case? Like, what does a jury award, and then what are the attorney's fees from a seven-week trial?
It was tough, you know, because also you're dealing with the judges. We also had a judicial deception claim that we thought was at least a mixed question of fact and law that should go to the jury. Well, after about 6 weeks of trial, the judge decided it was a question of law, and he took it away from the jury.
Oh, my God.
So in essence, a six-week trial, actually 7 weeks, we could have did in maybe a week. So that also cut off the amount of damages that we could ask the jury, because the lady never got her child back. Yeah. So now, instead of asking for a lifetime of damages, or maybe at least to the child turned 18, we got to ask for 3 days worth of damages.
Oh, wow.
Thank God the jury still awarded $3.1 million, but it should have been a lot more money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, how do you equate that harm? And for me, it all starts in jury selection. And I had the thought, there was a lady, and I just thought, ma'am, do you have any children? And she told me, I said, what are their names? She told me their names. And I said, can I ask you a personal question? When little Johnny, when they were babies, did you breastfeed? She's like, yeah, certainly. I said, well, why did you do that? And she went on kind of talking about it. And I said, one of the reasons I'm asking you that is because that affection, that bond, that the time that you had with your children, that's something that was taken away from my client. And I'm going to have to ask you to put a price on that. And of course, her response was, no price, that's priceless.
Yeah. And they kicked her off the jury. Defense dinged her, didn't
she? She was an alternate. So, but then she made it on the jury, became the foreperson. Thank goodness. But, you know, when you do something like that, the rest of the jurors get it, you know, because it's not an eye for an eye justice, right? And I actually said that. I said, if we lived in other countries, I'd be able to go into those social workers' home and rip their children right out of their hands, right out of their cribs, right away from whatever they're doing. And they would never see that child again. And I felt like I really wanted to do that. And that's really the way I feel with cops as well. Because they get up there, most of my cases, after civil rights cases, and I win the cases, the cops come over and shake my hand.
Wow.
I swear, almost every time. And it's just, it's like, are these guys, are you sociopaths? I mean, what is it? They like the fight, you know, that you actually stand up for your client. It's like a game for them. And they get, there's an adrenaline rush, you know, and they're like, hey, good job, counselor. See you on the next one. And I'm like, the next one?
And at the end of the day, it's not like they're paying anything.
They're not paying. Yeah. And even like what Asia was saying, you know, if you have punitive damages, at the end of the day, the cop gets up there and then he gets to talk about his family and his home and how much, you know, so they're not going to penalize the officer because you don't get punitive damages against the county.
Let me ask you, so when you have that question, and I'm going to get to Asia's story about promulgating change, but when you have that situation, like how do you weigh the punitive damages against the individual officers at trial so you don't hear those stories? Like, what's the play?
Well, you bifurcate, right, Carl?
Yes.
We bifurcate punitive damages.
The defendants bifurcate.
What does, we have non-legal listeners bifurcate. What does that mean?
The defendants are allowed to ask the court to separate the question of punishing the individuals, giving punitive damages, from the question of whether or not there's injury, whether or not there's damages to compensate the person for his injuries. And invariably, the defendants will file a motion in state court. It must be granted. In federal court, it usually is granted, where the question of punishing the individual defendants, because you can't punish the city, the county, or the state. So to punish them and to prevent others in the future as the conscience of the community from committing the same acts.
So if you, just as long as you have that question on the final verdict form, allows you to ask these questions in jury selection, have a theme throughout the case. And correct. For you, it really doesn't matter the award to the individual officer because they don't have a lot financially, right?
As a practical matter, if it ever gets to the point of there being a separate hearing on punitive damages, it's been my experience more times than not that the defendants will settle the case before then so that you're not forced to put the individual up there and have him talk about his own finances, his house, and that kind of thing.
And I had an interesting one where I had Lee Baca, who was sheriff at the time, and I got a punitive damages award against him. Oh. And, you know, so that I got all his financials and how much he was paying his ex-wife. And,
are you, Carl, the one that brought him down? Or you?
Well, yeah, right around the Tanaka Baca scandal, we were involved. I did a trial with the lawyer. Gosh, his name escapes me now. Great, great, great trial lawyer. And that's what I do. I learn from the best. You know, I get their transcripts. I go and I peek at what they're doing in the courtroom, and I couldn't do them this without the pioneers that have laid the groundwork.
And that's one thing that I would encourage your listeners who want to be lawyers to do. Watch good lawyers in trial. Every good lawyer steals from other lawyers. I know that I have, and I will, and I do. And you can always learn something and then adapt that to your individual style and make it part of your own.
I'm stealing. I heard Carl do his handing the baton off.
The baton. Absolutely.
I'm stealing that for sure.
I've not heard one better yet, my friend.
Well, I'll try to do it. So, Asia, we're going to pivot to you, and I think we're almost out of time. Yeah. But we're going to talk about promulgating change in cases that you've worked on, some things or stories you can inspire our listeners.
I did in my first criminal trial as the lead counsel, I want to say 10 years ago. It was my first go around, so I was clearly behind a little bit. The other attorney was 20, 30 years in. There was a case where my client was being accused of robbing a cell phone and $2 from a young man. The victim recanted his story in a general written statement that he had prepared, not specifically stating what actually didn't happen, but just said that he was not truthful with everything that he had shared. The judge in that case did not allow the jury to hear anything specific about his recanting. Mm. And so, of course, my client was convicted for robbing, quote unquote, $2 and a cell phone, and was sentenced to 22 years in jail.
22 years for a cell phone.
22 years in jail.
And let me guess, he was black, brown, not white.
Of course, he was a black young man. The Innocence Project actually took that case to the appellate court. It was reversed. Wow. And there was law that the jury has to hear exactly what the victim says
so
didn't
when
happen.
That happens, they're serving time. Like, what happens after that? Are they compensated for having wrongfully go to prison?
Well, in this case, he had a separate case that he had been convicted of. So the jail that he did do was he was going to do anyway, but he did get out and stay out. So it was a win-win for us.
But it's not wrongful legally if the prosecutor does something that's reversed as a matter of law. It'd be wrongful if they hid information or if they intentionally fail to disclose some information. But if there's some legal reason that that's reversed, it's not like it's wrongful to the way that they could then sue for having been in jail.
All right, so some final tips for our listeners. I'm going to start with Carl. What are some tips? Tell people right now how they can be a better lawyer and better person generally.
Find something that you can be passionate about. I tell my friends, colleagues all the time, if you can find that, I call it the sound of the genuine, that which touches your heart and can be passionate about that, you'll never have to worry about working a day of your life. You'll always be happy. Because if you find that passion, there will come joy. The money is the means, not the end. I've been rich and unhappy. Being broke but happy is fun. And you got to find that which brings you passion.
Mr. King? Other than writing those fancy novels that you write,
okay. Yeah. Love The Shining.
I know, and it's spelled the same, too, so I get it all the time. Along the same lines, you know, I even tell my kids, you know, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And wherever justice is in your heart and in your belief and in maybe how you grew up, for me, holding police accountable, it gives me a rush. I started off doing criminal defense, and I would do, like, resisting arrest cases. And you would just see these officers just thinking they can say and do whatever they want to do. And so I was able to use the justice system in order to hold them accountable. And just like we want our kids to be responsible, and if they're not, what do we have to do? We have to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. So in life, you have to figure out really what is your passion, what makes you tick. And if you love it, if you enjoy it, you'll live every single day happy and fulfilled. I've had jobs where I feel empty inside, and you know, I tell my partners from time to time, look, I don't like this. I don't feel good doing this. And it's okay, King, we'll find you something else. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much money I make, it matters how much change I make. Because nobody's guaranteed tomorrow. So if you like civil rights, I recommend you start doing a couple criminal cases. You get used to cross-examining police officers. You understand what happens after a crime is committed. There's a detective. There's an investigation. There's an IA. And how it filters all the way up to the district attorney's office and finally to the courts. Because a lot of judges were former prosecutors. And so you're up against everybody. So you got to stand tall. You got to stand strong. And look for role models. Look for leaders. Call Carl. Call Dale Gallipo. Call these guys who have been doing this for a long time.
Stephen King.
Call Stephen King.
Speaking about calling, let's plug, like, what are your, if someone is looking for or have a case that is a civil rights case and they can't handle it or don't want to handle it, or maybe it's off the street and someone has a civil rights violation, how do they get hold of you?
Douglas Hicks Law, 323-655-6505 in Los Angeles. CEDESQ on all platforms.
Excellent.
And for me, you can just do Stephen, STEPHEN, at StephenAKing.info. Or, of course, just look me up on courtroometiquette.com. I'll give you some tips on what to wear in and out of the courtroom.
And for me, as a woman, as a black woman, I would just encourage all the women who are listening that there is a place for you in the law. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be confined to this little box of what they think that you should look like, what they think that you should talk like, any of that. Be free to be your own person. Look for mentors. There are enough women out there at this point. There are not enough of us in the trial realm of this. I see there's more women going to law school, but they're not really doing trial work.
It's funny. Now there's more, it's 50-50 or more women in law school. And that's the thing that we're trying to change here a bunch is that should be who's in the courtroom.
Exactly.
I mean, why are the people we're representing are not who the lawyers are? It's strange. It has to change.
It really should. Mm-hmm. And I have been blessed to be in the presence of Carl Douglas every day, and I am a better lawyer because of it. And I would just encourage all women to become trial lawyers and have a voice, and don't be afraid to be called a bitch, because sometimes that's what it takes.
And sometimes when we're called a dick or a jerk, it's almost like a badge of honor, right? Yeah. Like, right. That's good advice. And you know what? I want to thank everybody for coming on.
So for Asia, Stephen, Carl, and Robert Simon, I'm Brad Simon. I'm going to take us out. Timmy, there's no sleep till justice. Let's hear the rest of that Regulator song. Booyah!
Destroy mode. Every other doctor in this case observed and said surgery decompressed the nerve. Now this doc is looking weak, and that's a known fact. He's sweating from his head down to his nutsack. Back up, because it's on. Concession City to Kev Doc and SLG. Just like I thought, the trauma is what put my client in need of desperate help. Surgery worked and the defense was in need of something else. Degenerative disc doc tried to sell. I said, ooh, I like your try. Pre-ax, did he have pain at any time? No evidence of that, it's going real swell. KC3927 Eggshell.